LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Christopher Knight, who joins us to discuss his latest book, God's Blueprint, Scientific Evidence that Earth Was Created for Humans. God's Blueprint puts the idea of God on trial. While the issue has been hotly disputed over recent generations with scientists on one side and theologians on the other, evidence either way has been thin on the ground. Faith, belief without evidence, has been the basis for the world's major religions. Most scientists reject the notion of God because they require factual, empirical evidence in order to accept any proposition as being real. However, new information is emerging which appears to suggest that there is underlying intelligence and purpose within the universe. When examined closely, the very existence of life and even the universe itself seem extremely unlikely. The slightest deviation in the so-called laws of nature, and none of it would be possible. Mainstream science maintains that this is little more than a happy accident. But the more we learn about life, the universe, and everything, the more mysterious it all becomes, and the more it looks like someone or something set it all in motion. Setting aside the dogmas of both science and religion, God's Blueprint asks whether everything we think we know is wrong, and whether the subtle realms of reality carry a message for humanity whose time has come. Hello and welcome, Christopher, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Good to be with you.
Now, Christopher, today we're going to talk about your latest book, which is entitled God's Blueprint. Subtitle is Scientific Evidence that Earth Was Created for Humans. Before we jump into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and your work, because you're a published author for some time now.
I'm a sort of accidental author because I spent 25 years conducting research for personal interest. And it was only after years and years of research that I thought somebody else might be interested in this and write it down. And the first book became a bestseller, and the research continued, so another book came out, and so on and so on. So there's been a whole chain of related research that's resulted in books. Although the books can look wildly different, they're all actually out of the same vein of research.
What would you say the headline, if we're going to have an introduction for listeners to this new book, would be? You know, what's the basic thesis?
I think it's something along the lines of God belongs to science and not to religion. I've never expressed it that way before. And that's no disrespect to anyone with religion. That's entirely their concern and their interest. I've been, I guess, throughout my life as close to being an atheist as makes no difference. I've always believed that there is some pattern and shape to the universe, that it's not completely random, but whilst I've been extremely interested in religion and the origins of religion, and have spent decades studying the evolution of religion and Judaism in particular, I've never felt any empathy with the belief systems. And it's only through science that I personally find something satisfactory. And when a few years ago, what I discovered through researching the megalithic period was unbelievable and impossible, and I tried to find various answers for it. And one such answer was that everything was created deliberately by a force, for want of a better word, God. And I tried to disprove it because I thought there's got to be another explanation. There has to be. And I spent years trying to find alternative explanations, and eventually I gave up and thought, there is a God. He did it, or she did it, or it did it. And that's this lady's book. And I just challenge any serious scientist to counter it in some way, to say, well, actually, that's wrong. It appears to me to be impossible, and I've shown it to plenty of scientists, and they say, yep, that seems to do it. And, of course, the majority of scientists are not atheists anyway, so it's not an uphill struggle. I think the people that I'm going to have some difficulty with are those who've got entrenched views about scriptures, although nothing I write has got any contradiction to their scriptures, but I suspect that's where I'll have some difficulties.
Well, I would have been called myself an atheist for a great part of my life, but gradually over the years, I just realized that for me personally, it wasn't a tenable position because I couldn't possibly know. And I know that some people believe sort of agnosticism to be some kind of cop-out, but really that's where I've arrived at. And I can't see that changing, because all I've discovered over the years, you know, research like yours, is these questions keep coming up, and I can't believe in a random universe because of the organization that's evident in it. But I guess where you get into difficulties is just with the preconceived ideas, you know, the term God itself has come so loaded. Did you ever have any other working titles for the book, or were you very clear that you wanted that to be in there in order to, you know, get people's attention, essentially?
The problem with that, the title of the book is considerable, really, are the problems. Because, as you say, God is a loaded word. It brings images of bearded men sitting on clouds and so forth for some people. It is connected to the entity that people pray to for the improvement in their lot. You know, this is nothing to do with the God of prayer. And to answer your question quite simply, no, I didn't think of alternative titles because God is the right word, because a creator God, that is, not a God that gives out favors if you ask nicely. This God that I found scientifically and through research is an entity that created everything, but didn't go away. They're still interfacing with humans, and all the evidence suggests to me, and this is speculative, the core of the book is not speculative, it's really hard-nosed, but the speculative bit is that it appears to want us now to pay attention and to learn, because there's a message there saying, you've now come of age, you now need to move to the next step. So we're being addressed by this entity that created everything, and for my money, I'm not talking about the Earth and humans and life forms on it. I'm talking about everything. It appears to be the entity that created everything. So it's very hard with the human lexicon to avoid the word God. There isn't another word, although it is loaded. People with religion have a very narrow view of their particular choice of the way God is, and that's fine for them, but there isn't another word, so I'm stuck. I have to use it. And unfortunately, some people pick the book up and think, oh, another religious crank trying to prove that what they believe is true. Well, I have no beliefs, so no, I'm not trying to persuade anybody of anything other than ask them to look at some facts that are hard to dispute. And if they can be disputed, I'd love to hear it. So the title is a problem, to some extent, but there was no way around it.
And of course, currently, I don't want to say in vogue, but sort of getting attention in these sorts of discussions in the media is the intelligent design school. And sure. Of course, it's a bit unfortunate, really, but I suppose it was inevitable that something like that would rise up. The more that science showed us certain things, that this counterposition would have to be found, especially when overtly simplistic religious ideas were shown to be bunk. You know, they just didn't stand up to any sort of test or reason. Something would come to fill the gap, basically.
Sure. One of the problems that I've got, and people that like me that suddenly find themselves in this middle ground, is that scientific principles being absolutely used, but the results are finding things that are more spiritual, if you like, on the softer side of things, but they're hard evidence. Now, the people that love the hard evidence immediately suspect it's all nonsense, like intelligent design. There are a group of people that claim intelligent design, but they started out with their preferred beliefs and then went seeking the evidence to support it, which is not scientific, and that's why, in my view, most of it's bunkum. But you get other people like Anthony Flew, the great, great philosopher of the 20th century, who spent his entire career as a leading atheist, poo-pooing all religion, writing books and papers throughout his life, an eminent career, saying the whole concept of God and religion was a disgrace and an affront to the human intellect. And then he turned around and said, I was wrong. In his 80s, he turned around and said, there is a God. And it wasn't because he was facing death and getting old and he was getting sentimental. It's because the science said the evidence has changed. And he said, I've got to be big enough to say, I got it wrong. The science is here, and I go where the science takes me. Clearly, he said, there is a grand plan. He had no interest in intelligent design. He thought those people were ridiculous. And he got no interest in the idea of a salvation-orientated God or life after death, and he didn't believe any of that. But he's categorically said, this is a designed job. The whole thing is set up from the beginning. Now, that's a real scientist and a super scientist, because he was brave enough to stand up and say, my whole career is turned on its head. That takes real strength, because there are so many academics that they think their work and their papers are more important than the truth, and that they resist changes because it doesn't fit with their career patterns. And equally, people that claim intelligent design are claiming it because it supports their scripture. And they say things like, how can the human eye or the eye of any animal have evolved by chance? Well, actually, very easily. You can't overturn evolution with silly observations like that. Now, having said that, evolution remains a theory, and there are some difficulties with it. But many religious people don't have a problem with evolution, and many evolutionists don't have a problem with the idea of God. So they're not absolutes. There's this shades of grey from black through to white, and the truth, as ever, is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, well, as you point out in the book, they're not mutually exclusive. The idea
not
of some form of self-organizing creative intelligence and the process of evolution absolutely could run in tandem.
There is no doubt that DNA was the coding, the hugely complex elements within DNA on life forms on this planet, or the so-called junk elements of it, have not changed from the beginning. They're loaded with huge amounts of data, and they're there from the beginning. So the whole idea of evolution could have been pre-programmed in, because if you manufacture something, you manufacture it in stages. But you have the plan in the first place. So DNA is just one of the vehicles and techniques used by this creator. So there is no contradiction between theologists, religious leaders have no difficulty saying, of course, evolution is real, but what has that got to do with God? That's just his technique. As Isaac Newton said, I can describe gravity, I can describe the movements of the solar system, but so what? That's just the way God set it up. I don't want to know how things work. I want to know why things work, and I want to get close to the mind of God. Some scientists, some low-grade scientists, think if I can describe something, ergo, that's it. It's conquered. But all they're doing is describing it in some nebulous terms, and they think, therefore, they have ownership of it. So that isn't the case. I mean, obviously, we humans are probably the most advanced creatures in the whole of the universe, but there's a trillion times more things we don't know than those things we do know. So we're playing very much at the edges, and we don't understand things like DNA. We're starting to get there. But the complexity in there is such that any intelligent person has got to start wondering, you know, how did this happen? Can it be the result of an infinite number of accidents? Why does the universe exist? Why does carbon exist at the basis of life forms? It shouldn't do. You know, we are the result of an infinite number of impossible coincidences.
The whole issue of naming things, as you mentioned, not even describing them, but something like dark matter, it then becomes, okay, it's dark matter, now we've got it, but of course, no idea. It's something that's theoretical. They did the same with the Higgs boson. And there's lots of, when you get into the world of quantum physics, there's lots of stuff that's in there you'll find in a glossary that's never been observed or measured.
Yeah, absolutely. And once you get into the world of quantum physics, people say, oh, that's ridiculous. Well, quantum physics is ridiculous. You know, it's completely counterintuitive, but they accept that it does it. But they're describing things that they can't possibly understand. Even like something as simple as electricity, people talk about it all the time. We know how to control it and use it, but no one really understands what it is, per se. We can break it down into its, what we call its component parts, but life is so much richer than just being able to describe things. Having said that, I think the greatest thing that ever happened anywhere is science. The whole process and principles of science are the most wonderful thing. And I think any god, any creator, would be the first person to praise science, because that is the real religion. And in my view, the researches I've done into the Neolithic, for example, it's become clear to me that the scientists and the priests were one of the same. And it's only in relatively recent history that there's been a divergence between the two.
Yeah, bizarrely, we now have a situation that you referred to earlier where some scientists have become religious in their approach, if you see what I mean, in terms of it doesn't matter what the evidence says, that they've got a theory or perhaps something that was established to be the case and turns out not to be or whatever. You've got careers and grants hanging on it. And they sort of behave in sort of fundamentalist ways, what's referred to these days as scientism.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think science is a wonderful thing, but scientists aren't always. it's like many things. They are good, but they're not. The practitioners aren't always as good as the principals. And there is, in my view, confusion between technicians and real research scientists. You know, I mean, people talk about medical doctors being scientists. Most of them are not. Most of them are wonderful people. You know, my daughter's a doctor and a lot of friends are doctors. I'm not anti-doctor in any way, but they're applying the rules of science in a prescribed way. For me, a real scientist is someone who's research-based, pushing the boundaries out. And one of the problems with modern science is because it's so specialized, it's so narrow, and no one's taking the broad view. So we had great scientists sort of in the 18th century, for example, because they could move across boundaries between physics and chemistry and whatever they wanted, whereas today that's frowned on. A leading academic that contacted me because of some of my research, he's got a PhD from Oxford in physics and one from a Canadian university in chemistry. And he said the problem with chemists is they don't understand physics, and the problem with physicists is they don't understand chemistry. You've got to have this sort of broad view. And in many respects, it would be much better if leading scientists spent more time on philosophy, such as Richard Feynman, perhaps, and theology, and became more rounded. But it's asking an awful lot of these people. But I suppose that's where amateurs like myself sort of fit in, because we can take the building blocks from different areas and synthesize and say, hey, if this is true, and this is true, and this is true, doesn't this rather throw up an interesting new fact?
Not to be ragging on science here, because we don't want to do that, but just while we're talking about it, the resistance within that establishment to sort of enthusiastic amateurs, you know, the idea that if you're not accredited, you know, with the appropriate qualification, you're not even fit to make a, you know, a speculation. Never mind a statement about something.
But it's also within disciplines. You know, if you're within one discipline, you can't make a statement outside of it, even if it's very close, because you will be hounded down. You know, like archaeologists get very upset if people from other disciplines come in. Like I write a lot about Alexander Thom, who was an engineer who spent half a century taking apart megalithic sites. And of course, archaeologists don't like it, because you're a professor from Oxford University and your discipline is engineering. What do you know about archaeology? Well, actually, he knows 100 times more than they do, but that's not the way that they see the world. So they get very protective and say, get back in your engineering box. So it's not just people like myself who are outside of academia, not people who aren't working within any university. It's people who've got to stay within their department and their corridor within the department. It really is frowned upon for people to be thinking outside of their box, which is why it doesn't happen a lot. Careers can be destroyed in the system. And if you're applying for research grants, you know, you've got to play the game. So, you know, there are practicalities within science. As much as I love science, it's got challenges.
Well, there's politics in science, like there is in everything in life. Anything that involves human beings is complex.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're talking about the Vatican or any religious institute. You're talking academic institute, a parliamentary situation, a big corporation. Politics are everywhere. You're right, of course. Yes.
I had a geologist on here a couple of years back called Robert Schock, who's written about...
Oh, I know Robert very well, yeah.
Okay, well, I know he's been absolutely slaughtered many times in public, you know, for daring to open his mouth.
But he's a lovely man, a very good scientist, and he's open-spirited man, you know. He just loves the truth. But he's not a very good politician, I suspect, because he says what as he finds, which is very refreshing, but it won't win him friends and favour inside the establishment.
I don't know if you've seen that recent clip that Graham Hancock posted online, but he's another guy who's dared to step out and say what he sees, and there's a video that he posted of him in Egypt about to give a presentation, and he's absolutely being torn strips off by this Egyptologist. I can't remember this guy's name, but he's senior in Egypt, very senior guy from, you know, within the establishment.
And he wasn't, I know who you mean, yes. Well, he's an idiot. I mean, I know Graham very well, and I've disagreed with him over the years over various things, but I have to say, as time's gone on, I've got a lot more sympathy with some of the things that Graham says. And he certainly deserves listening to. In Egypt, though, it's more political than ever, because they've got their difficulties now. But it's been more about tourism for them. They don't actually care much about ancient Egypt. It's just a means of creating revenue. I mean, I love Egypt and I love Egyptians, but I've been to the country 40, 50 times, you know, I just love it. But there is a certain dishonesty that goes through the establishment in Cairo in particular, shall we say. And I can understand how Graham's had continual difficulties. Like Rob Bavall, you know, I mean, but he's very politically astute in understanding how to control, because he was born in Egypt, the politics there. But yeah, you have to be political. I refuse to be political on that because I don't care. I don't write to make money, and I don't write because I want to be famous. I write because I enjoy the research, and I'll share it with anybody who wants to have a look. And that makes me dangerous because so many people are controlled because they want promotion or fame or fortune. Well, I'm not interested, so I can afford to offend, and they hate you all the more for that.
Yeah, exactly. But you mentioned earlier about scientists of the sort of 18th, 19th century, you know, that there was a time when it could be,
yes,
you know, interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, whatever you want to call it, because these guys were basically enthusiastic amateurs who, you know, funding themselves, et cetera, et cetera. But it was really after the Renaissance that the sort of mechanistic view of the universe came to dominate everything. And obviously, you know, for a while, you know, religions were claiming to have the truth, and it kind of, the pendulum swung a little bit too far in one direction, I seem. And this is where some of the resistance is coming in now, because people like yourself and other researchers and writers are suggesting this, you know, that it's not just a cold, hard, accidental, meaningless universe out there, that there is, it does seem to be some sort of underlying intelligence, some sort of deliberation. And that, of course, anything, for some people like the Richard Dawkins of this world, anything that's even remotely sniffs of religion is to be guarded against, you know.
Sure. In some of my books, I've used some of the same arguments against religion as Richard Dawkins, coincidentally, certain aspects of religion. But I think Richard Dawkins doesn't do himself any favours. He doesn't say he's an atheist. I think he gives himself 6.9 out of a 7-point scale in disbelief. You know, he, on the basis you can't prove a negative. So he accepts that there is a tiny possibility that there is a God, but then is fairly abusive to people that have a religious belief. Now, he's got an extraordinarily mechanistic view of the universe, which I have to say, pretty closely shared. I don't think I was ever quite as far as him, but I was of that ilk. I mean, in the late 1960s, I was in art college, and I never smoked a joint or hadn't. You know, I was very straight laced for somebody in doing what I was doing, because I thought straight thinking's important, and I accepted the establishment view as a starting point on most things. And only when I found it wanting did I slowly challenge it. But the older you get, the more you realize, if you've got an open mind, I think, that things are infinitely more subtle. And not only that, when I personally have stumbled across, through the researches I've been doing, hard, cold facts, which tell me categorically that a lot of people that have been talking about stuff that I used to think was a bit weirdo are actually probably talking sense, in that it isn't a mechanistic universe. We know that scientists will agree that everything, everywhere, adds up to precisely zero in terms of the existence of matter. And the movement and the turning of the universe is precisely zero. There is nothing there if you want to be completely bloody-minded about it. And yet, clearly, there is. So what has become clear to me is that in the late Neolithic period, people were way ahead of where we are now in their understanding of the way the world works. Partially, we'd call spirituality today, and partially we'd call science, because they weren't caught up in the mechanistic, particle-driven aspects of it, that they allowed their minds to work on a different level, a different plane. Now, this isn't woo-woo stuff. This is testable, checkable, hard science. And these people had information that they have no right to have had about the nature of the universe, and it's testable and provable that they did. Now, then you've got to sort of say, how could they have done, given that they did? Well, you've then got to start looking at the structures that they built and the science that they built into them, and it takes you to a strange place. And as a friend of mine from Northern Ireland, hard-nosed Bluff Ulsterman, who's an engineer, spent some time with me, and he just said, look, I don't know. I do not understand what these people were doing, but whatever it was, if we could understand it, it would melt our brains down. And he went from a transformation from being completely hard-nosed engineer to saying they've got something that we can't grasp. And for sure that's the case. But I think we are starting to grasp it. So there's this idea that every day us humans get a little bit smarter. We learn more and we get better at everything we do. Not so. We go in cycles, and there have been better cycles before, and we're rediscovering things we've forgotten. Like, you know, the meter is 6,000 years old, and when the world was there was a first attempt to measure the world, they reverse engineered what had been done thousands of years before. History is amazing, and we've forgotten more than we know. I think Graham Hancock's always said this, and I was always a bit skeptical, but I know for a fact it is now the case. We've forgotten more than we know. And if we intelligently dig it out now, we can leap forward. And there are, as we've been saying, vested interests in stopping that. But it's going to happen. It is going to happen.
For more on this idea of cycles and how our intelligence and consciousness can be affected, I would point listeners to an interview that they'll find in the archive I did with a guy called Walter Cruttendon about his book Lost Star of Myth and Time. And he talks about, you know, the cycles of precession, for example, and even the longer cycle, a much longer cycle, as the solar system itself moves around the galaxy. And he basically says, yeah, this absolutely affects us. And what, you know, backs up what you're saying, you know, that it's not a one-way trip in that sense. And I mean, you could also, you're citing those ancient peoples and their knowledge. I mean, this idea that every day we get a little bit smarter, well, I don't know, sometimes I look at the news, you know, and I see something like Black Friday over in America, and I see people they're behaving like apes would be a disservice to apes, basically, you know. So we are learning more, but it's very much about cycles, I think, and Walter's theory was actually we've been coming out of a long dark age and we're emerging from that now, but we're still, how can I put it, close to the bottom.
Yeah, I think you can look at it two ways. You started out by saying that the commonality of failure is where humans are together, because there's politics everywhere and there are people doing things for their own self-improvement in the way that they perceive things. But overall, we're moving in the right direction. But I think, and the researches that I'm conducting are suggesting that the power that be, God, if you like, is telling us, very clearly communicating with us now, not in any soft way, but in a hard way, saying, now's the time to leave your adolescence and move on to adulthood. And a good quality adult is someone that remembers how to think like a child. And I think we've got to rediscover. We've been through this sort of very serious phase of life, which I must admit I did myself as a younger man. And then you've got to relax and sort of say, actually, we were better at this before. Spirituality is not an embarrassment. It's not a collision with science. It's part of it. There is this mechanistic view that science is somehow this dry thing that describes things, but it's not. It's about getting inside the way human brains actually operate and work and interface with the world, because humans are only part of the Earth. We are the thinking, or the most advanced thinking part of the Earth. We're all one, and we've got to start looking at things in a slightly different way. And in writing my new book, God's Blueprints, I've deliberately started out with a little bit of philosophy, then looked at religion and asked the questions of why before I've introduced the researchers that, and the hard numbers, the facts, the mathematics that says, hey, there's a big problem here, for the standard explanations. Let's see what this actually means. And I've come to the conclusion that for us to really move forward, we've got to go in for the soft stuff now. We've got to start understanding the nature of what it is to be a sentient being that thinks, not from the brain, because it doesn't happen in the brain. It's not as mechanistic as that. For want of a better word, the soul is something much bigger and broader that isn't within a physical limitation. And the words like soul have got the same problem as God, in that people immediately see them in a religious sense. Well, they don't have to be in a religious sense. And spirituality doesn't refer to religion. It refers to an openness of the human consciousness, if you like, which may or may not involve religion. So we've all got to get a lot more subtle.
In terms of there's us undergoing some form of transition, when I kind of zoom out and look at the state of humanity on a global basis, I'm reminded of a teenager having a tantrum. It really is like that. But what you've just been referring to is this, you know, growing awareness. And again, this is something that we understood a long, long time ago, but then came to reject, is that there's the material and the non-material, mind and matter, there are interactions here. And because we don't have, according to certain scientific standards, we don't have quote unquote evidence for some of this, or we haven't worked out yet how to measure it, you know, how to do it that would stand some sort of scientific test, that the temptation has been to say, oh, it's all, there's nothing to it whatsoever, you know, whether it be telekinesis or remote viewing or precognition, you name it, you know. But for me, science is one way of learning about the world. It's not the only way, but I can actually expand that to overlap more with what you're saying, which is that this other stuff, the non-material, the stuff of mind, has its place within science. It's just been pushed away for a long time, but it's coming back in now. It doesn't matter how many people resist it.
I think science is everything, but science isn't what a lot of modern scientists think it is. In my book, I make reference to homeopathy as a case in point. Now, I haven't a clue, or basically particularly any interest in whether homeopathy works or doesn't work. I understand the principle is counterintuitive, that the arguments against it, when you use standard science, are considerable. But I think any scientist that says it's automatically wrong is making themselves look stupid, because homeopathy doesn't work in the way that chemistry, drugs based on hormones or chemicals, work. So you can't use blind trials, because they are very homeopathic remedies, apparently. I know nothing about it really, but are created for the individual. And you can't therefore give them to a whole room full of people and say there is a 6% improvement, as you would do with a conventional drug. So when scientists are insisting we have blind trials for homeopathic remedies, in the same way that there are for that NICE would use for new drugs, doesn't apply. As I say in the book, it's like insisting that a bicycle has no airworthiness certificate. You know, airworthiness certificate. So for aircraft, bicycles run on the ground. They're two different things, but a lot of scientists don't seem capable of understanding that they've got to change the whole criteria of the way they look at something. Now, again, I repeat, I have no idea whether homeopathy is nonsense or whether it's miraculous, whether it's wonderful, but I know enough about it to know that the underlying principle has got some suggestion that there is a logic there. All I know is that. But it just highlights the pig-headedness of a group that says, if we can't measure it with our instruments, it doesn't exist. And we've got to change that. And it is changing slowly. All progress is dependent on the unreasonable person. So we've got to have a group of people that keep pushing and being unreasonable and saying, no, come on, let's think again. And it's a growing group. So I don't think there's going to be a big change in my lifetime, but hopefully, you know, in the next generation or two, science is going to flip over and start to understand that the complexities of the world are very different to the way they think. I mean, one scientist I know, he's way into his 80s now, he's maybe 90, who spent his life working on the human brain. And he told me that he said, the more we learn, he said, I thought I understood the human brain 50 years ago. He said, but at each stage, we realized we were wrong with what we thought before. And the more we realize is that ancient Hinduism had it right. He said, all the time, it flips back to ancient Hinduism. And he said, I don't understand why. But they seem to have understood it thousands and thousands of years ago better than we did. So he's opening his brain to go backwards. We have to go backwards to go forward sometimes.
Regarding homeopathy, again, I just know the headline of what it is, supposedly. You know, I don't know anybody who's ever tried it. I've certainly read people debunking it. And as you say, it sounds counterintuitive. It even sounds nonsense on one level. But the beyond trauma, i.e. having your arm severed, or toxicity, say drinking a bottle of bleach, the most important thing, it seems to me, that affects your health is actually your mind, what you think. And the placebo effect is well documented, but I think it's a bit of a misnomer in a way, because the placebo by definition doesn't do anything. So it should be called like a mind effect, you know, that someone heals themselves through. So my point here is that what we think and what we feel, our emotions, our thoughts, what we focus on, does actually, it can have a marginal effect on not just our physical matter, but physical matter in general. And that's where I think the research is taking us now. That I mentioned earlier, you know, the material, the non-material, mind, matter, there are interactions here. There always have been. They're just not well understood. And because they sound counterintuitive, you know, when taken in the context of 20th century science, they get thrown out. But I mean, placebo effect for me is a great one, because that still gets dismissed as like, it's nothing. Well, it's very far from nothing.
Well, of course it is. Because any GP will tell you that the vast majority of complaints will be cured by the mental attitude of the people. There are certain things where there's a physical absolute reality, as you say. If you drink bleach or have your arm chopped off, where there's something physical got to be done, but most of it is in the mind, and any GP will tell you that. Some will say it's as much as 98%. So of course, placebo effect doesn't mean to say it's worthless. I mean, there is an idea that placebo, it means nonsense, trickery or something. It doesn't. It means belief. And if the person believes something will happen, it will. So there's a lot of complexity there. I mean, I write in a book about where there is sensory deprivation units where everything can be taken away from you apart from the inner self, if you like. So you're not all this confusion of daily life of touching things, smelling things, seeing things, feeling things is removed, and you can reflect inwards. Strange things can happen because the mind, which doesn't mean it isn't synonymous with the brain, the mind is different, can be freed to do things outside of the blindedness we have of our normal senses, which are wonderful. Of course, I'm not criticizing our senses; they were essential, but they can get in the way. The clutter of life means that we can't see the wood for the trees. I'm sounding very woo-woo here and very spiritual, but it isn't that. It is a physical scientific reality that we exist in a strange universe, and you shouldn't be limited by the physicality of everything just immediately around us.
In terms of, you know, your book, we mentioned, you know, that the Earth and indeed the universe kind of being wound up and set off, and in some ways, it's, as you are working out, you know, created for, you know, for life as it is to exist. I mean, besides the idea of the Goldilocks zone, you know, that the universe is not just not too hot, not too cold, it's just right, and slight deviations in all sorts of metrics would tip the whole thing out of balance, and, you know, the universe, it wouldn't even, it couldn't even exist in its current form. Beyond that, you reference some very interesting, in particular, numbers in your book, which were first explored in a previous book that you wrote called Who Built the Moon? And there's all sorts of fascinating, well, some people would say coincidences that you document, and there's even more in this book. And it's, even as someone like myself, who's quite averse to sort of dealing with numbers, it's extremely interesting.
Yes, numbers aren't an easy thing. I mean, I'm no mathematician at all, but it's quite relatively simple arithmetic. But the reason I've been drawn into all this is through understanding megalithic systems of measurement, and then understanding that they understood the dimensions of the Earth and the heartbeat of the Earth, the spin of the Earth. They 5,000-6,000 years ago used the meter and the foot and the gallon, and all imperial measurements go back into the Stone Age. But not only that, they describe and define the dimensions and the movement of the moon and the sun and the Earth, and the interrelation between all of them, with complete exactitude. It's not marginal. You know, it's not 99%. It's 99.99% in all cases. And you start to use the word coincidence would insult anyone's intelligence, because it's consistent every time. It is a repeating pattern that demonstrates a blueprint, which is why the book is called God's Blueprint. If you put a modern motor car in a sealed unit under the ground, and it was discovered in a million years' time, and the people from the super future unwrapped it, they would deduce the metric system, because all the panels and the engine and everything's built with millimeters and centimeters and meters, liters and so forth. They would deduce that. Now, that's what we can do with the Stone Age structures. We can absolutely deduce it. But then we deduce that it also defines the mass, the density, the spin, the rotation of the Earth, the Moon and the Sun and all of its dimensions. And you think, how did they know that? It's because their minds were somehow linked in to the heartbeat of the reality of our planet and the sun and the moon. I mean, I wrote Who Built the Moon because it clearly couldn't be Russian and American scientists have already said it, that it's impossible for it to be a natural object. Now, I started looking at it, and it's actually built to all these dimensions. So I wrote Who Built the Moon, but then that still didn't answer all of these issues of how these numbers keep on reoccurring. I mean, Thomas Jefferson in the United States, the president, the third president of the United States, and the guy that set up the Declaration of Independence, he was a great scientist, and he started working out measurements. And he said, this is a set-up job. It comes from prehistory. Why is it a cubic foot of water holds exactly 1,000 ounces, weighs 1,000 ounces? why? And people like him could using modern science, rediscover what the ancients already knew, but they knew it through some other means. So what I'm laying out in the book is hard-nosed evidence for anyone that understands numbers to say, you tell me how this has happened other than a grand plan, and yeah, I'll be very impressed. And I've had lots of scientists look at it, and they've all gone, whoa, there is no explanation. That is extraordinary. So I've tried to keep the numbers to a minimum, but it's hard evidence. It's not the Goldilocks zone thing is obviously there, and it's far more than just a happy zone. It's an impossibly perfect zone. But that's just a negative observation, if you like, in that saying how could it be that everything's conspired to be so perfect. But what I've been able to identify working with Alan Butler in particular is these exact numbers that drive it. They're the engine of it. And they didn't come about by accident. And the Earth, Moon, and Sun. And it's pointing at knowledge that we're about to get. You've said we feel like the human race, the human species at the minute feels like an adolescent that's running around like a headless chicken. It's grown to be physically adult in form, but its brain hasn't caught up with it yet. You know, like 14, 15, 16-year-olds, they're all very strong and full of spirit, but they haven't quite got the maturity. I think we're about to get that maturity, and we need to step back and look at these numbers because the information is about to be given to us, and I think I know where that information is about to come from. We are now coming of age, and I think God, for want of a better word, wants to reconnect and take us into adulthood, because we need to. And it's a big, softer, more subtle move than we would ever expect.
You mentioned DNA earlier, and I mean that's pretty magical stuff if you start looking at the detail there. I mean, most people think, oh yeah, I know what DNA is, building blocks of life, but when you really start to read about it, it's just like, what are the chances of this? And in fact, recently I read a book. I mean, we think we're adults, we think we know about the process of, you know, conception and childbirth. Even if you've never been a father, you know, it's like stuff you learn on pretty early on in life. But I actually read the detail of the process, not, you know, not just sperm meets egg, but there's a lot of the numbers and the absolute, I mean, and the word that kept coming into my head was magical. It was like, because there's just all these things, I never didn't need to know any of this, so I never looked into it. But when I actually studied it, I was like, wow, this is an amazing process. It's just incredible. Mm. You know, it's so much more than that simple sort of, as I say, sperm meets egg. When you actually look at the details of it, where I'm going with this is when you start looking at aspects of life and then consider that, as I understand it, life can only come from life. You know, life can't come from something that was never alive. It can't come from something that's now dead. So it ponders the question about origins, and it really just lends more credence to your basic idea, if I'm honest.
Well, there has been an attempt to create life with DNA, and that actually putting new information into the DNA, but that's only been a creating a variation on what's already there. Anthony Flew, I mentioned earlier, the great philosopher of the 20th century, who changed his mind about atheism. It was DNA that finally took him over the line, and he had to say, as you say, this is magical. This is not science. You know, he gave up on the Dawkins sort of view that A plus B equals C. There's something beyond anything rational going on here. It's so super special that we've got to acknowledge that there is an intelligence behind it. DNA did not come into existence by simple accident. It relies on accidents for producing variations as it moves forward, but that's all programmed into it. The core elements don't allow any deviation. They've been there since the beginning. when there was a single cell life form, and the parts that allowed accidents to happen, and it's when there's a happy accident that it's allowed to develop further. And that's what we call evolution. But that's only a part of DNA. There's much more to DNA than just evolution. And in my view, the mathematics demonstrated by the Moon, Sun, and Earth relationship have been deliberately put there to unlock how we should read the coding in so-called junk DNA. I think that's where our information is coming from. And there's enough information in hidden in DNA, we know, just massive amounts of information. We could rebuild the whole basis of the human race on the information that's in there.
Well, thinking about alternate origins, because this is what it always comes down to when you get into these sort of discussions, you know, why is there something rather than nothing? And did the universe, sure. Was the universe really created from nothing in a big bang? And then you start to imagine what is it possible for nothing to exist? And one idea I've been drawn to recently is the idea that something has always existed. That again seems counterintuitive because it has to come from somewhere. But then that's just our way of thinking.
Absolutely. But to understand quantum physics, you have to rid your brain of such simple thoughts. I mean, it's an old idea of if God created everything, who created God, or what was there before the Big Bang? I mean, these are not helpful ways of thinking about anything. I mean, there's a significant evidence now that there always has been something, that the Big Bang wasn't in any sense a beginning. But these are just human limitations of being able to conceive a notion, and you've somehow got to get those to one side to allow yourself to understand the bigger picture, which is where people from the British European megalithic, or indeed perhaps Australian Aborigines, or people from the jungles of South America have been much more in touch with understanding these things. They're sometimes referred to as primitive peoples, but the reverse can be the truth, in that they've got much greater insights into other aspects, even if they are not controlled and directed in the way that traditional Western thinking would like. There are doorways into different ways of viewing the world. And we've got to get out of this, sorry Richard Dawkins, but I could use your name again, we've got to get out of the Dawkins-esque way of viewing everything and become much more sophisticated.
Yeah, because I don't think that his sort of nihilistic atheism is really, that's what I'd call it, is really a useful counterpoint to religious fanaticism. I don't see that's one cancelling the other out. I see it's just making it worse for everybody.
Yeah, they're as silly as each other, one will never overcome the other. But who cares? Thinking people are going somewhere doing something else. There's much more constructive things to do than either sit there and disappear at your own posterior reading your scriptures, or sitting there insisting that your textbook has got is the only way of thinking, straight thinking. There's a whole different world out there. Both those groups are like a two-dimensional plane, and there's this third and even fourth dimension out there to blossom into, to think about things. And we have to enter an age of sophistication. To some extent, I suspect that people that cling on to old scriptures are probably hanging on to strands and elements of when we were better at some of this stuff. But it gets lost in the retelling, in my view, in many ways, that the scriptures themselves become revered rather than the essence of the message that was in them. So when they become transcribed or even translated, they lose something and they lose something and they lose something. So I think religion needs to grow up, and I think science needs to grow up. Science is growing up, and some religion is growing up. But it's time for the two to come together. Philosophy, theology, religion, science, they've all got to become part of a single whole again.
A couple of things that spring to mind, just reflecting on, you know, the origin and nature of life. One is those experiments that were done in a lab where basically they were simulating lightning strikes on some kind of recreated primordial soup. You know, some people have speculated as how life got started on Earth, and great excitement when they produced some amino acids. But I still see those things being quoted as, oh, well, we know we have created life in the lab. That's certainly not the case. And the other thing related to that recently was the publicity around the Kepler planet they've observed, specifically 22b, which I think is the one that's in a habitable zone around what we deemed to be habitable around a sun-like star. And I saw on social media when this was in the news, I saw being shared around were mainstream media stories. And there we go. There's a picture of Kepler 22b with green continents and blue seas and clouds over it. And people, you know, well-meaning people getting really excited. And if that's what the planet actually looked like, I'd be beside myself with excitement just to find out more. But they can't photograph that. It's 600 light years away. And all the speculation about it is just, that's all it is. But I've seen people getting really excited about this because they think that that artist's illustration somehow represents the rock that is out there.
There is so much nonsense put out by academia there are the silliest religions. If you've got any sort of training or natural ability to analyze information, it doesn't take you very long to know they're talking absolute garbage. The extrapolations of that they use to suggest that these planets are habitable are absolutely insane. There is nothing to suggest they are even vaguely. They spot a planet that is similar distance from its star. The star is within a few hundreds of percents of our star. The planet is within a few hundred percents of our size. We know nothing about its density. I mean, Venus is very close to Earth, but, you know, Venus is like hell. You know, a microbe couldn't last a millisecond. They just talk nonsense. Life couldn't develop on hardly any of these planets. And my personal feeling is there probably is life in the universe, but I doubt it's much beyond the microbe anywhere. And I'm utterly convinced, and a lot of people won't like this because they like to believe in aliens, I don't think there's any life form anywhere that's as advanced as we are, or even vaguely, because of the difficulty of getting a planet that does what we do, which is all courtesy of the moon and the sun relationship, which is very, very, very specific and unique. So I personally think we are it. Now, that's, you know, that's only an opinion, because there are lots of possibilities for me to be wrong on that. But these descriptions of these so-called habitable planets are a joke. They really are silly. And well, the scientists that publish them should be ashamed of themselves.
Well, that's the reason I mentioned it, was, you know, just that... And also the creating life in the lab is just how unlikely
they haven't created life in a lab. What they've done is they're able to prove that that is exactly how it didn't start. Everyone who knows anything about it now knows that is completely discredited. That lightning strike into the primordial soup is not the way that life started. That's the one thing we can be sure about. Yet it's repeated all the time because the urban myths just roll on, don't they?
Yeah, you're statement there that you feel really that we could be it. I mean, that's controversial, isn't it? Because in some ways, it reflects some religious points of view. And you also mentioned in the book, you can maybe elaborate on this, that the possibility that the Earth might actually be at the center of the universe. I can't remember exactly how you describe it, but that was interesting in itself. But of course, people will be very dismissive of that because we've been tempted since we moved out of, you know, religion dominating our collective thought. We've moved away from the idea of humans being special or, you know, having any purpose or meaning or anything like that.
Well, I'm not a scientist, so I can't pass an opinion on anything like that. So I'm only repeating what heavy-duty dudes have said, that there is a lot of evidence that suggests we could be at the center of everything. Now, I reference other people's work there because I'm not vaguely qualified to express an opinion, but it sort of fits into the specialness that I'm finding from other areas. So there is the pieces on the chessboard are sort of arranging into telling a story that there is something happening there. So it's not my theory that we're at the center of everything, that it appears to be this large bubble, and we're in the center, and outside this bubble is all sorts of other things, but the bubble is also at the center. However, one defines what a center is in a boundless universe, I don't know, but when reading the book, you'll see its reference to the people that are actually saying it. So it's not a wacky theory. It's a mainstream piece of science. All I'm doing is drawing it together and saying maybe this is true too.
And as you mentioned earlier, whether it be the special relationship between the moon, the sun, and the Earth, or DNA, whatever it happens to be, that there's possible that we could be looking at unraveling some kind of set and forget messages.
Absolutely. the organization known as SETI, it was looking for intelligent life around the universe. It's looking for incoming messages. Well, it's foolish beyond belief because the assumptions you make to assume that a message is going to hit us just that we've become capable of seeing those messages and they're transmitted millions of years ago, it just doesn't stack up at all. As people like Paul Davies point out, that leading scientists point out that if you wanted to put a message, you'd carve it into rock. It would be a big lump of big object that you would set and forget and leave there. And that's what the moon is. It is like, hey, look at me. Look at my dimensions, look at my movements, look at my rotation, look at everything, look at my mass, look at everything about me. I'm not normal. I'm here to tell you something. So that is far more important than incoming radio messages from some distant galaxy.
And they're still waiting, and it seems to be all quiet out there.
Yes, I really don't think there's anything out there that's going to communicate with us. Apart from we're already being communicated with by whoever set up this whole thing. There is a definite communication from the designer. It's time for now. It's not any old time. It's time for right now. Pay attention is the message.
Well, we certainly need to do something, don't we? Christopher, today we've been talking about your latest book. Once again, that's entitled God's Blueprint, Scientific Evidence That Earth Was Created for Humans. That's widely available. Anything else you'd like to share with folks? Maybe you've got a website to plug?
I haven't, unfortunately, because I just do all this pretty well sort of part-time, and I just physically haven't got around to a website yet. So sometime I will do, but at the minute I'm afraid not.
Okay, so obviously people then, if they want to find out about the work, then as you say, you've got a number of books, and if they just go onto their favourite book-selling website and stick your name in, they'll be away.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, Christopher, thanks once again for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Pleasure. Thanks, Greg.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is legalizefreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were 7 UK pounds, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.